From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Republican, Roy Moore, arrived at his polling place on horseback. The Democrat, Doug Jones, voted at a Baptist church. The uniquely Alabama special Senate election is underway. One of the most consequential and close special elections of the year, a race roiled by sexual misconduct allegations against Moore, an uphill climb for the Democrat in this deeply red state. Let's do a quick check-in with Andrew Yeager, a reporter and host at WBHM in Birmingham. Andrew, what are you seeing at the polls?
Well, right now, the story, at least anecdotally, seems to be a steady to strong turnout. The Secretary of State's office in Alabama predicted a 25% turnout, and his office says that we're on track for that. It sounds like a pretty dismal amount, but when you compare it to the primary, 14% turnout there, the GOP runoff, 18%, so 25% actually for a special election in the middle of December, it might be the best we can do.
Well, they certainly are aware of it. Here's Moore making his pitch to voters last night to drain the swamp in Washington.
We're up to our neck in alligators. We're up to the neck in people that don't want change in Washington, D.C. They wanted to keep it the same, keep their power, keep their prestige, and keep their position. And we've got to change that.
So borrowing a page from a candidate Donald Trump there, but here's Doug Jones last night.
We've lagged behind in industry. We've lagged behind in education. We've lagged behind in health care. It is time that we take a road that's going to get us on the path of progress.
Is it safe to say, Andrew, African Americans are a key for Jones, while getting Republicans who might not like Moore to vote for Moore are the key for him?
That's pretty much seen as the path for Jones. He needs those African-American voters that generally vote Democratic and needs them to come out in high numbers. And there isn't just a majority base of Democratic voters in Alabama, so we need some of those disaffected Republicans, moderate Republicans, to actually cross over and vote for him as well. Particularly, we're looking at areas around suburban Birmingham, other suburban communities. That's where he really hopes to pull this thing out.
Right. What about last-minute wrinkles? Last night, we saw Roy Moore's wife saying that her husband is unfairly being portrayed as anti-Semitic. She went on to say, one of our attorneys is a Jew. That, of course, is seen as anti-Semitic by some. You know, Jews are the money changers or the lawyers, or it's like I have a black friend. Jones, meanwhile, as we heard on Morning Edition, is steadfastly refused to speak with the national media. Is that going to backfire on him?
I really can't say one way or another, other than to say that Jones has tried to walk this line during the campaign about how much he is associated with national figures in the Democratic Party, how many of those outside voices, because sometimes in a culture like Alabama, those sorts of associations can have blowback.
Yeah. Andrew Yeager, reporter and host at WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama, on a big political day there in your state. Andrew, thanks so much for touching base.
Great to be with you.
Well, I just returned from Alabama, where I was talking with Andrew and with voters yesterday. And in conversations with people in Birmingham, you can't escape the political history of the place. Going back to the former governor of Alabama, George Wallace.
In the name of the greatest people that have ever trod this earth, I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny, and I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
That speech by Wallace in 1963. He was a Democrat who served as governor of Alabama three times in the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. He famously stood in front of the entrance at the University of Alabama to try and stop black students from enrolling. Wayne Flint is a professor emeritus in the history department at Auburn University.
There are two major historical principles about Alabama that grow from our distant history, and Wallace incorporated both. One is, we dare defend our rights, which is the state motto, and it's sort of a bunker mentality where you think the world's against you, everybody hates you, everybody makes fun of you. And so, understandably, what you wind up with is a bunker mentality, and Wallace was the embodiment of it. And the other characteristic of Wallace was that blacks need to know what their place is, and they need to stay in their place. And so it was about not allowing Yankees to put you down and not allowing blacks to participate in the political process.
So has race always been at the center of Alabama politics?
It is, has, and always will be, as far as out as I can see, yes. Alabama politics begins and pretty much ends with race.
Today, the population of Alabama is about two-thirds white and a little less than one-third African-American. High-profile black Democrats poured into the state over the weekend to campaign for Doug Jones, some holding events at churches. And Flint says there's an important distinction there.
An evangelical is an evangelical, right? No, not in Alabama. It's all about race. And so black evangelicals are very different, even though theologically and even on issues like abortion and same-sex marriage, they may agree with white evangelicals. But they figure there's a larger issue here about justice and fairness and equity in society and protecting voting rights, whereas Republicans could care less about those things.
Another key moment in the state's history is on display at the Civil Rights Institute in Birmingham, where we met the Institute's education consultant, Barry McNeely, in front of a small jail cell with just a twin bed, a toilet, and a sink.
We have April 12, 1963, where the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King is going to be locked behind these bars, and he's going to pen his letter from Birmingham jail.
And these are the actual bars?
These are the actual bars. That's the actual stool. We have the two keys to the cell, but they're kept in archives.
King was jailed for 8 days after being arrested for protesting for civil rights without a permit.
I think the letter from Birmingham jail is so significant in a symbolic way, is you're using the confines of incarceration to liberate people. It really exposes what African Americans had to deal with in terms of segregation in their lives. And he states that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere in this letter, and how the weight, because one of the things that was said often was, is you're pushing too hard, you're pushing too fast, you're asking for too much at one time, and we need to do this gradually. And Dr. King pushes back against this gradualism, and he says, you know, basically we've been waiting for over 100 years now, and this letter is designed to try to wake people up who are of good faith to say, you're on the wrong side of history, basically.
The Civil Rights Institute is right across the street from the 16th Street Baptist Church, another landmark in the state's history. It was bombed in September 1963. Members of the Ku Klux Klan planted dynamite at the church, and the explosion killed four young black girls.
The 16th Street Baptist Church started out as a beacon in the city of Birmingham for the African-American community. But during the Civil Rights Movement, it took on a greater importance when they started using it for planning and demonstrations and things of that nature. And it was targeted for a bombing on September the 15th, 1963, after Birmingham City schools were forced to integrate.
The bombing shocked the city and the nation. And just 5 months after writing that letter from a Birmingham jail, Martin Luther King gave a eulogy for the victims.
They have something to say to every politician who has fed his constituents with the stale bread of hatred and the spoiled meat of racism. They have something to say to a federal government that has compromised with the undemocratic practices of Southern Dixiecrats and the blatant hypocrisy of right-wing Northern Republicans.
The bombing of that church, the death of those four little girls, was an awesome example of man's ability to be inhumane to other men. But from that example, people pushed back. And you had things like the Civil Rights Act, and people began to draw closer together because I think they were able to see the precipice of this hate and how bad it was.
There is actually a direct connection between the bombing of that church and today's election. The Democrat, Doug Jones, prosecuted two of the KKK members responsible for the bombing and sent them to jail. In recent years, Alabama has been represented in the Senate by Republicans. Richard Shelby, who was elected as a Democrat in 1986 and switched parties in the 90s, and Republican Jeff Sessions, who was elected in 1998, replacing a Democrat. Today's special election is to replace him in the Senate. As we were leaving the Civil Rights Institute, Barry McNeely pointed out a quote on the wall.
This quote by Dr. Martin Luther King that greets all of our visitors when they come here is a window into who he was as a leader. When we read the words, I like to believe that the negative extremes of Birmingham's past will resolve into the positive and utopian extreme of her future, that the sins of a dark yesterday will be redeemed in the achievements of a bright tomorrow. We hear these words, and they're powerful words, but they're made more powerful by understanding that Dr. King was delivering these words as he preached the eulogy of three of the little girls who were killed in the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing.
And do you feel like today in Birmingham we've reached that bright tomorrow?
We're close, but there's still a way to go.
And today will soon be a part of the state's history, regardless of who wins, another turning point for Alabama.
If you're looking for a book for a young adult this holiday season, might we suggest Robin Benway's Far From the Tree? The New York Times does. They call it unforgettable. It just won this year's National Book Award for Young People's Literature. And it's very cool and very contemporary. One of the characters has a lesbian girlfriend. No one bats an eyelash. Another is starting a new relationship that snaps and crackles like Tracy and Hepburn. And all three of the main young characters are wrestling with aspects of adoption. Grace is a 16-year-old good girl who becomes pregnant and gives the baby up, which plunges her into a new understanding of the biological mother who once gave her up. Maya is in a wealthy family she doesn't look anything like. Her adoptive mom has a drinking problem. Joaquin is a foster child who's been rattling around the system, afraid to let his current foster parents adopt him, lest it all fall apart. And about a third into this tale, we find out they are siblings who find each other and set off to find their bio mom. The book is Far From the Tree. Turns out they haven't fallen too far from theirs. And author Robin Benway joins us from the NPR West Studios in Culver City. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
In the acknowledgments, you thank people who helped you tell this story. Some of us are familiar with some of the trials of adopted children, especially teens. You are so spot on in some places. Do you know about this?
No, I didn't. I had gotten the idea from the book based on a lyric and a song, and I kind of realized that I was wading into very uncharted territory for me. I don't have any experience with adoption. I'm not adopted. I haven't adopted. So I spent about 6-7 months doing a bunch of research. I talked to adoptive families. I talked to foster families. I talked to liaisons who worked between the birth mother and the adoptive family. I spoke with an adoption attorney. If I heard that you had a friend who was adopted or adopted in that 6-month period, I probably talked to them.
Well, and by the way, what was the lyric in the song?
Oh, it was a Florence and the Machine song. Mm. It was called Cosmic Love. And the lyric was, a falling star fell from your heart and landed in my eye. And I just had this image of a biological mom, you know, putting her baby up for adoption. Mm. And that baby carrying that love of that bio mom, even though he or she may not know it.
Oh, that's just killer right there.
I was as surprised as anyone to hear that lyric and to think of that.
Well, I didn't want to go with just my personal observation. So I've been reading, you know, Adoptive Families magazine and looking, you know, scrolling through doing some research. And a lot of the things that you're hitting on happen in the teen years. You know, people who have adopted children might tell them things as they grow up. Your mom or dad loved you, but for different reasons, they couldn't help you in the way they wanted. And we mm-hmm. could, so we did. But by the time they get to the teen years, they want more.
You know, it's funny. When I spoke with someone who was adopted, I said, what would you, if I could put one thing in this book, what would you want me to know? And she said, don't make the child ask you for information. Obviously, at an age-appropriate level, mm-hmm. please let them know about their biological family, whatever you can tell them. And so there's a conversation in the book at one point that Grace has with her parents where she says, I shouldn't have to ask you. You should be telling me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's also a difficult line. When do you know when your child's ready to hear about their biological family?
They
what
tell
if
you.
You don't know anything. Yeah. What if they don't,
they'll
what
say
if they
no.
don't know that much? Yeah. And it's hard. And I think in every single family and every single situation is completely different.
Right. Well, Grace loves her adoptive family.
She does.
16, becomes pregnant, and gives this baby up, it immediately triggers. Well, what you and again, did this come from research?
Yes. You know, I think for Grace especially, it's very difficult because she herself is adopted and has a wonderful family. She loves her parents very much. But this baby is the first biological connection she has to someone else that she knows of.
I hadn't even thought of that. Her biological child is her only link to her biological mother and father.
Yeah, and when you think about that, it makes Grace's choice all the more heartbreaking. And yet she has that ability to think ahead and to think, I can't, for her personally, she cannot care for this child in the way that she would want this baby to be cared for. Mm-hmm. And that is what launches her choice. Grace isn't looking for her mom as a child. She feels that connection to her mom as a biological mother.
Yeah.
She looks for her not as a daughter, but as a mother.
Well, first she has the shock of finding out she has siblings, which her parents tell her. Did you speak to adopted people who talked about that shock of there's someone else out there?
Yes. Yes, I did. I spoke to a very close friend of mine who I had known even before I'd gotten the idea for this book. I knew that she had looked for biological siblings and found them. And at every age, it is a shock, regardless of if you're 50, 20, or, 15. And it's like with siblings that you grow up with, some you get along with wonderfully and some you don't. It just comes down to, in a way, personality. And that was one of the things I wanted to explore is what makes your family? Is it your personality? Is it the time you've grown up with them? Is it that biological bond? And there's no right answer.
All right. There's also no perfect adoptive family, even though they are angels to have done it. And Grace meets her sister Maya. And Maya, who would seem to have a picture-perfect life in this beautiful marble-floored home, has a mother with a serious drinking problem that she's trying to monitor. And then there's Joaquin. They find their brother heartbreaking. He's never been adopted. So you really lay out that choirs do sing when children are adopted, but it's not always perfect.
No family is perfect. It's still people living together and trying to love one another. And when I first started writing the book, I had no idea that Maya's mom had a drinking problem. And one of the first scenes I wrote, I went back and I read it, and I thought, gosh, this mom, every time I mention her, she has a glass of wine. She's drinking wine. And in a way, with alcoholism, it can be a very deep-rooted secret in families. I didn't know that about Maya. I had to find it out.
Oh, that's funny. Joaquin.
Yes.
Oh, if we can say anything in this segment, it's that there's so many children waiting for adoption.
Yes.
And I'm seeing that they're staying longer in foster care, that adoption might be off. He's Hispanic. The foster parents who want to adopt him and adore him are white. He's never been with anyone from his birth culture, so he doesn't know how to speak Spanish, and yet he's treated by people in a certain way as if he is Mexican,
yes.
I think it is. Can you read? You have a paragraph that just will put a dagger in your heart about what it's like for these kids as they get older and realize they have not yet been adopted.
Joaquin understood that there probably wouldn't be anyone at his parent-teacher conferences at school listening as the teacher told them what a good artist he was. There was no one to take a picture of him standing under the blue ribbon that someone had pinned to his drawing at the school's art fair in fourth grade, or to drive him to that one birthday party across town in fifth. Some of his foster parents had tried, of course, but it wasn't like there was a ton of money or time to go around, and Joaquin had long ago figured out that if he didn't expect people to be there, then he wouldn't be disappointed when they didn't show up.
Mm.
That was hard to write. I did a lot of research about foster care and race and kids who are growing up in foster care and who are left in foster care. I did a lot of research about private adoptions and how much they cost and the cost difference between, let's say, a white baby girl and a newborn boy of color and why people are willing to pay more for one than the other. And, these boys of color, they grow up to be men of color in the foster care system and they're just left behind. And I really wanted to represent and look at these kids through this one character of Joaquin, especially because Joaquin's sisters are white. His half-sisters are white.
Same mother, different fathers.
Exactly.
It's interesting. I was reading up on the Center for Adoption Support and Education and was reminded that being a teen, everyone feels different from their peers. But if you're an adopted child who's been feeling different from your family, it's a pile-on.
It is. Growing up is awful. It's so difficult. For Joaquin, it's the idea of in some states, once you turn 18, you're out of the system and you're on your own. And he's getting ready to launch into an adult world when he's barely had a foundation as a child and as a teenager. And I think when he meets his sisters, they begin to provide the beginning of that foundation.
Yeah. Did you talk to parents too?
Yes, I did. I did. I talked to adopt parents. I talked to a father who adopted two boys out of foster care. I wanted to show that these parents are imperfect, but they love their children very, very much, including Joaquin's foster parents. They adore him. And, you know, there's one moment where Joaquin says to them, you know, they're white, he's Hispanic, and he says to them, you are experiencing this very differently than I am. People look at me very differently than they look at you. And I think that's a very eye-opening moment for them. And I wanted to show that these parents aren't saints, but at the same time, they're willing to hear what he's saying and work with that and learn from what Joaquin is trying to tell them.
Well, and also he has a backstory that is why he's holding these people at arm's length, his feeling about himself and how he's not worthy and something he did in the past is going to hurt everybody. It's just heartbreaking, but it's so, I think the word you used is eye-opening. It's so eye-opening.
You know, Joaquin keeps very deep secrets, and for me, the author, I had to kind of dig around to find it. And when I was doing research and I figured out what that secret was based on my research into foster care and adoption and the systems in place, it broke my heart and I felt terrible that this is what had happened to him, but I knew that that's what he wanted me to find out. I felt so close to these characters. You know, I felt so attached to them. I felt so maternal toward them because I was putting them through so much. And to see them sort of come out on the other side and have this book be completed has just been, I feel like my kids went off to college in a way. They don't need me anymore. They're fine. But yeah, to find out their secrets for each character was, you know, wrenching.
That's Robin Benway. Her new book, Far From the Tree, just won the National Book Award for Young People's Literature. But adults could read it too. Robin, thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
A falling star fell from your heart and landed in my arms. I screamed aloud as it tore through the it's left me blind.
Florence and the Machine. It's Here and Now.
The French company Unibail Rodamco has agreed to buy the shopping mall giant Westfield for just under $16 billion. It's the latest move in the changing world of retail. Westfield is an Australian company that owns and operates 35 malls in the U.S. Robin Farzad is host of Full Disclosure on NPR One. He joins us now. Hi, Robin.
Jeremy, happy Hanukkah.
You too. And by the way, we hear all about shopping malls being in trouble right now. Why would this company want to buy a mall chain?
If you think about it, in the existential crisis that is the retail property market right now, you have a binary proposition. You can kind of beef up or bow out. And I look at this as Westfield, whose shares have been slumping for a while, really storied, really A-plus properties, have been kind of the envy of the industry for a long time. Big in London, gets 70% of its revenue in the United States, taking a price and selling, getting out before it gets even uglier.
Why does a company like Westfield do better right now than others, though?
They're more upstream. If you look at their stores, whether you're in Beverly Hills or the World Trade Center retail property beneath the rebuilt Twin Towers area, or, for example, in London where they're dominant, they have the Apple stores, Zara, the things that have so far been mostly immune from Amazon's onslaught. But they're also feeling the pinch. They're getting telegraphs from these tenants saying that when our leases come up for renegotiation, we're going to demand much better terms. It's really nasty and doubtful for everybody.
How does this play into the ongoing battle with Amazon, basically, and all kinds of retail outlets having trouble?
You know, Jeremy, I still can't get my head around the fact that of all the things Amazon could have done to start the year, it took out Whole Foods. Who could have seen that coming? There were more people that had guessed that it would buy UPS and become a global logistics company. But that threw everybody in the industry for kind of a crazy curve. Now, if you're a CEO, you see a nondescript van pull up to your house on a Sunday and deliver boxes from Amazon, and you're thinking, oh my gosh, we just figured out free shipping. And these guys had shacked up, and they have a brick-and-mortar presence. You see Walmart has some kick. You see CVS, which is endangered, wants to buy an insurance company, Aetna, and their CVS stores and Targets. So everything is up for grabs, and Amazon is one of the largest companies in the world. So it's really this deal more than anything else is indicative of what I said earlier. Either you're in it or you got to get out right now because it's going to get so nasty.
Well, and when we're talking about shopping malls, I was reading that Amazon has actually been going out and buying shopping malls and turning them into distribution centers.
You know, it's such asymmetric warfare with Jeff Bezos because he's not judged on same-store sales or some of the other vagaries that Macy's and these beleaguered likes of JCPenney and Orvis are. I mean, he just has this force field that Wall Street loves whatever he's doing. So it's so difficult to fight with him. Walmart has recently come out and has figured out its online game, but then that's just one part of the whole equation. Do you do returns in stores? Do you offer free shipping? Does anybody have something that competes with Amazon Prime? There is so much fear and loathing in this industry right now. I'm just so grateful I'm a journalist.
Just a few seconds left, Robin, but do you think we're going to be going to shopping malls in 10 years?
I'm not going to a shopping mall right now. I mean, I do all my shopping online. I go to a grocery store, but even then Kroger and Wegmans and all them are insisting that they can deliver to me. So, you know, Olive Garden maybe takes me to the mall.
Okay. Unlimited breadsticks. Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure on NPR One. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The fires in Southern California are largely under control, except for the Thomas in Santa Barbara and Ventura counties, larger than all of New York City and growing and just 20% contained. Thousands of firefighters battling it. How are they doing? Matthew Chambers is a fire engineer, former captain from Sequoia National Forest. He's acting as public information officer for the Thomas Fire. Matt, there are male and female inmates. There's the famous hotshots, firefighters from states like Colorado. Tell us more. Who's there?
Yeah, so we've got, you know, firefighters from all over the nation. They treat it just like it's their backyard, like, you know, you're fighting your fire in the backyard of your neighbor's house. Mm-hmm. And they treat all the citizens here like they, you know, they are their neighbors. And it's a tough, demanding job. And it's really, you know, it makes me proud to be a part of it.
Well, tell us how tough, because you had these extraordinary winds, 60 mile an hour, red alerts, and we know that they go for days at a time. You don't go in and out. You stay there on the scene with medical units, we understand, with each team on the fire line.
So it's kind of hard to explain to, you know, a person. Take your worst day of working out and times that by 100. You get out there and you come in to a fire that's got winds, you know, 50 to 80 miles an hour, ash, ember wash, steep terrain, flames just blowing through the mountains in this tinder dry, you know, Southern California chaparral. This is, you know, 7-8 days that these guys and girls have been out there. And they're, you know, they tell us, hey, you know, you have to do this shift, but if there's a job that needs to get done, I know every single one of them out there is going to stay out there and do their job until it's, you know, until it's finished.
Well, also, the charge for the firefighters in these fires is to keep them from spreading, you know, create fire breaks. As you say, this is, we're talking about digging, right, and chopping and trying to keep breaks.
So you get in there and you're putting in lines, 50-foot swaths, and it's hard to imagine that on top of these ridges for miles. And just imagine that in 120 degree weather, you know, with a 45-pound pack on your back to carry all your water, all your safety gear, and then you've got another, you know, 15-20-pound chainsaw on top of that. And then you also have to throw brush after you cut it. So it's very demanding. Some of these people that you see out there are probably in the best shape that you'll ever see.
Well, I've actually been out trying to observe firefighters on a fire line, and I couldn't handle it. I mean, I couldn't breathe. And right now there's health alerts for the residents in the same areas. People are saying to them, don't go outside, don't work out, try to remain quiet. Because of the ash and the smoke and the quality of the air. And here you guys are, as you said, the roughest workout of your life.
Yeah, and it, you know, they've given out over 200,000 N95 masks so that, you know, to help some of the public. And one of the main questions that they always ask us is, well, why aren't you wearing that? And, you know, the job's so demanding that is just too much, and you just push on and push through. And it's not just physically demanding, it's very mentally demanding, because you have to keep yourself safe at the same time. And under the time constraints of, you know, we've been up for 16 hours or 24 hours, and we've been going from place to place to place, and it's constant interaction for both your mind and your body.
Yeah. Look, we hear there was a captain who actually lost his home. His home burned down.
On fires, I've actually had some of my own seasonals lose their homes. And I can't speak to this, but I can speak to that. And it was just devastating because that's your friend. And he's losing his house while he's out protecting somebody else's.
Look, my friend Beth, who's out there, is trying to work on a bumper sticker, hug a firefighter. But what is the...
We appreciate it.
What would you tell people, though, is the biggest thing they can do to help you?
We're supported by a great group of firefighters that come in and create a little city to support every single need from, you know, food to showers to lodging, you know, whether it's sleeping on the beach or getting us into hotels if they can. But the biggest thing you can do right now, if you are, you know, in Santa Barbara, Montecito, Carpinteria, is just listen to those alerts and know where you're going to go. If you can get out of the area, of course, you know, because if we have to deal with evacuations and you know, understandably panicking public, then we can't get in there and actually fight the fire.
That's Matthew Chambers, fire engineer with Sequoia National Forest and public information officer there at the Thomas Fire. We're speaking to him there in Ventura County in California. Matthew, thank you so much.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Back to work. Well, California and other coastal areas will have another environmental problem to deal with in the years to come. Engineers are building seawalls and raising buildings to counter the sea level rise. But some scientists are pitching a more natural approach. All it takes is a little grass and some time. New Hampshire Public Radio's Jason Moon reports.
You just want to come up to a plant, you know, go a few inches next to it. Go straight down if you can.
Armed with gardening gloves and a small shovel, Allison Eberhardt digs on hands and knees in a small field of beach grass on Hampton Beach on the New Hampshire coast.
And then lift up, and then that's it.
Standing around the University of New Hampshire scientist, a handful of people watch and learn. They're here for a kind of gardening lesson that, in theory, could save their homes.
Remember that this is a plant well adapted to burial, so you can bury it pretty deep, and then we just want to backfill.
It's a lesson on how to plant beach grass, the kind you see sprouting from the tops of sand dunes. You may not think much about sand dunes, just another obstacle on your way down to the water. But for people interested in coastal resiliency, that is, how well a shoreline can cope with major storms, sand dunes are great. They offer protection from storm surge and flooding, and compared to things like seawalls, they are really cheap. Sand dunes are created naturally by ocean winds sweeping sand up the beach. Beach grass aids that process by acting as a sort of net, catching the sand as it blows by. Along the coast, many homes have a dune in between them and the ocean, but many don't. Eberhardt and other scientists with the New Hampshire Coastal Adaptation Workgroup, like Dave Burdick, are trying to change that.
If you're at risk, you want to capture that sand. You don't want it to blow away. You don't want it to blow in the street and have DPW come and take the sand away. You want to be able to capture that sand because you want to protect your homes.
But even though the state is offering free beach grass to any homeowner who wants it, it can still be a tough sell. Larry Deschler owns a house on the beach in Seabrook, New Hampshire. He came to this workshop intrigued by the idea of a sand dune in his yard.
Just to know what my options are for protecting my property.
But there's one big hang-up for him. And for a lot of homeowners, once you plant beach grass, you can't pull it out, at least not without permission from the state. That's because sand dunes are protected in New Hampshire under wetland regulations. And remember, dunes are natural systems that grow and sometimes move on their own. And that's what worries Deschler. If he starts planting beach grass now, in a few years, he could have a dune tall enough to block his view of the Atlantic, and he fears reduce his home's value.
If I would be allowed to keep it low enough that still protects my property's value and then high enough that it protects my property, that'd be good.
But Seacoast Realtors will tell you more and more home buyers are interested in beach houses that do have sand dunes. It's part of a cultural shift of opinion on sand dunes that's thanks in part to Superstorm Sandy. Sandy's famous storm surge devastated entire communities on the East Coast, but not all of them. Gary Engelstad is mayor of Bradley Beach, New Jersey, a town that was largely spared because of its sand dune.
We were back in business the following day while other towns were just, they were like zombies. They just didn't know what to do. They went out and looked at their beach and it was gone.
Engelstad says after the storm, some residents who had earlier complained about the height of the dune called him to apologize.
So yeah, the skeptics were not skeptics anymore.
Back in New Hampshire, scientists are hoping to instill a similar love of sand dunes without a big storm to make their point. And they are making progress. At the end of this workshop, two homeowners decide to take some beach grass with them for their sand dunes. But those homeowners already had dunes. They're just hoping to strengthen them. And others, like Larry Deschler, who was concerned about his property value, decide to hold off, at least for now.
Yeah, I don't want to start something that goes out of my control.
Allison Eberhardt, the UNH scientist leading the workshop, says they've always known it would be an uphill climb.
Absolutely. I mean, you can see why it can be a tough decision, you know. I mean, looking at it from a coastal resilience perspective, no-brainer. Looking at it from I have this incredible beach and this view, and this will compromise my ability to enjoy it. I get that, too.
She says all they can hope to do is win over homeowners and build a more resilient beach, one yard at a time. For Here and Now, I'm Jason Moon.
Hanukkah begins this evening. The 8-day Jewish Festival of Lights is celebrated with the lighting of the menorah, games, and of course, food. And who better to talk to us about the food than Here and Now resident chef Kathy Guntz, who joins us in the studio now.
Hello.
Kathy, happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah to everybody.
Yep. So, there we go. Okay,
so,
bye.
I'll answer your question with a question.
Just, you know, Hanukkah celebrates the reclaiming of the Temple of Jerusalem by the Jewish army. The Maccabees, 2,000 years ago, they wanted to light the menorah, but they only had one day supply of oil. Miracle!
You stole my story.
It lasted for 8. Well, I love
the
story.
Well, you know, actually, in recent years, many scholars are admitting that the story of Hanukkah is actually very difficult to verify.
Stop.
It's kind of convoluted. Hey.
We're going with it.
Okay, let's go with it. The most important part of the story is the oil, that when they went back to clean up the temples and rededicate it, there was only enough oil for one night, and yet it burned for 8. Mm. So the traditional foods we eat on Hanukkah all center around. Yes, indeed. I mean, for many people, it's the one time of year that they'll eat deep fried food. Mm-hmm. Not me. I'm a big fried chicken fan. But let's get back to Hanukkah.
Okay.
The most traditional of which are latkes or potato pancakes. Now, potato pancakes are actually very simple. You grate the potato. But this is where the confusion begins. Mm-hmm. Do you grate them on the largest opening of the grater? Do you grate them on the little knobs?
Oh.
Do you grate them? You can grate them any way you want, and each one will give you a different textured latke. So it's grated potatoes, egg. Some people add a little bit of flour or matzo meal. You could add cornmeal if you're gluten-free. Salt and pepper. That's the pure basic latke. And you have one on your plate.
Oh, so good.
Yeah. Okay. And then you take that basic recipe, a grated potato, a little bit of egg, a little bit of flour, and then you can go nuts with them. You can use sweet potatoes. You could use parsnips. You could use beets. I've also made a carrot and ginger latke, which has fresh ginger and dried, and these wonderfully sweet winter carrots. They taste so fresh that they almost defy the deep frying.
By the way, you had the carrot and oranges or something.
Yes, last time.
These winter carrots are unbelievable.
Aren't they fabulous?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're super sweet.
Sure.
The point is that you can really experiment. The third latke I brought comes from Joan Nathan, a very well-known Jewish cookbook author. She has a book, King Solomon's Table, and these are fabulous. They are grated zucchini, feta cheese, and dill.
Mm.
And when they come right out of the fryer, it's almost like an arancini, the fried rice ball that they eat in Italy, because the cheese is in the center and it oozes and it's completely irresistible. So those are just 3 types.
Any tips for people on deep frying things?
Yes, I do. And I actually learned quite a bit at 5:30 this morning when I made these. Even my dog was looking at me like, why are you up frying latkes at 5:30 in the morning? You want the oil to be hot, but not too hot. What I do is I heat my oil in a wok. It's the perfect shape to contain the oil, no splattering. You only need a few inches. Many people have preferences about what they use. Some only use safflower oil. I do a combination of Crisco and organic safflower oil. So the Crisco coming from my childhood and the organic safflower oil and my today type of cooking. You want to, if you have it, put a candy thermometer into the oil. And I keep it there because the oil temperature fluctuates enormously. And that way you can keep an eye on it and you always know, oh, it's getting too hot.
What's it supposed to be?
Well, around 350. Mm-hmm. Every recipe, for me, that's about right. It browns them, but it doesn't burn them. And literally, I'll take the wok off the flame if it starts to shoot up to 400. But that thermometer really lets me in. Can we talk about toppings for
Please.
A minute? Okay. So traditionally, horseradish, spicy,
so
wonderful with traditional latkes. Sour cream is also a traditional topping, as is applesauce. But why stop there? I put out a whole table of toppings, fresh chives chopped, fresh dill, smoked salmon, smoked trout, creme fraiche. Just, you can go nuts with these things because they really are a whole meal. And then many Jews for Hanukkah make jelly donuts for dessert, also another fried food, again, harking back to the story of the oil.
I was going to say, harking back to the story of the Hanukkah jelly donut.
That's right.
Which there isn't one.
But you don't have to make your own chocolate coins. You can just buy them.
No, you can buy the gelt. And, you know, Hanukkah is, many people think it's the Jewish Christmas, but it is not at all. It is not considered a major holiday. It just happens to fall around the same time as Christmas. And growing up, like I have two daughters, it was very difficult, you know, all the build up to Christmas and all the kids waiting for the tree and Santa, and they're eating potato pancakes and spinning a dreidel, but it lasts 8 days. And traditionally, kids get a gift on each night. And it's a pretty wonderful celebration, very peaceful, and very much a holiday that's really about freedom.
Yeah, and a miracle.
Here in our resident chef, Kathy Gunston, we've got the recipes she's been talking about at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thanks so much, and
Thank
happy
you.
Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah. Mm-hmm.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. It's hard to talk when you've had horseradish. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.